content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 2024 Walter magazine. We begin with Raising the Bar. With grace and strength, Deborah Austin paved the way for black ballerinas. By Hampton Williams Hoffer. From the front of a sunlit studio on Stony Brook Drive, Deborah Austin guides the next generation of dancers at our city's professional ballet company. Her soft demeanor does not betray the force that she has been in the world of ballet, fiery on stage, meticulous as a teacher, and brave in blazing her own way in a historically white elitist art form. Austin was the first black female dancer to join the New York City Ballet, and later the first black ballerina to become a principal dancer with a major American ballet company, the Pennsylvania Ballet. Fortunately for Raleigh, her transcontinental journey as a ballerina, wife, and mother landed her here as a ballet master for Carolina Ballet and teacher at the School of Carolina Ballet. For Austin, the art of ballet holds immense importance. Quote, "It matters because it's so beautiful," she says. "Gorgeous costumes and bodies and music. It's an incredible art form. Like anything, you have to learn to appreciate it, and then you can see the beauty of ballet." Austin was 8 years old in 1963 when she and her family moved from Harlem to the Bronx. But after one ballet class, the teacher, a former Rockette from Radio City Music Hall, promptly informed the Austins that their daughter had, quote, "no talent." Undaunted, Austin and her parents found another studio. By the time Austin was 12, she had earned a Ford Foundation scholarship into the prestigious School of American Ballet, the associate school of the New York City Ballet. 4 years later, renowned choreographer George Balanchine came in to observe a class just after summer break. He saw something in Austin and handpicked her to join the New York City Ballet, making her the company's first black female dancer in 1971 at age 16. After 9 years with New York City Ballet, Austin moved to Switzerland to join the Zurich Ballet, where she was promoted to soloist. There, she expanded her repertoire by dancing numerous principal roles, including Myrta in Heinz Sporli's Giselle, and touring throughout Europe. Then, in 1982, Austin further solidified her role in history by accepting a contract with the Pennsylvania Ballet under then artistic director Robert "Ricky" Weiss. Weiss made Austin a principal, which in turn made her the first black ballerina to reach the rank of principal dancer with a major American ballet company. While breaking barriers as a black woman in ballet, quote, "race wasn't at the forefront of my career," end quote, Austin says, but she does recall one incident when she was cast as a lead in La Sfida, one of the world's oldest surviving ballets, which features dances by an air spirit called a sylph. The man staging the production claimed he didn't really see Austin as playing a sylph. When Weiss asked him why, he said he simply hadn't seen a black sylph before. Weiss replied, "Well, have you ever seen a sylph before?" "Ricky was colorblind, and I was fortunate," Austin says. "He cast me in so many classical ballets because he believed in me, and that was not always the story with other directors." While in Pennsylvania, Austin met Romanian dancer Marin Boru, who won the gold medal at the international ballet competition Varna, and who has performed as a principal dancer and toured in numerous companies in the U.S. and Europe. Austin and Boru danced together for 8 years before Austin's retirement from dancing in 1990 at age 35. They were married in 1992 and both went on to teach ballet in Florida. Then Weiss was hired as the director of a brand new regional ballet company, Carolina Ballet in Raleigh. Believing in their artistic values and vision, Weiss recruited Austin and Boru to train and develop the dancers at Carolina Ballet, and they moved to Raleigh in 1997. Our daughters were 5 and 18 months, and bringing a young family here was perfect, Austin says. They've made Carrie and the Carolina Ballet their home. At Carolina Ballet, Austin helps make the ballet accessible to everyone, training 10-year-olds up to pre-professionals, opening doors for young dancers to learn and train. Both now ballet masters teaching class at Carolina Ballet, Austin and Boru impart their knowledge onto young dancers and company hopefuls. Jan Burkhard, principal dancer with Carolina Ballet and the chairman of the faculty for the School of Carolina Ballet, counts herself fortunate to have worked closely with Austin for nearly 2 decades. Debbie has the ability to give you confidence in your dancing. She's bestowed her knowledge on many, and anyone can attest to its authenticity and honesty, says Burkhard. Anyone who has had Debbie as a teacher is lucky. Carolina Ballet has grown to become one of the country's premier professional ballet companies, producing some 400 ballets and garnering international acclaim. While Austin has returned to the School of American Ballet as a guest teacher and serves on the Alumni Advisory Committee on Diversity and Inclusion there, she remains devoted to Carolina Ballet as headmistress. She's the most unassuming, gentle being to ever grace this studio, oozing the love she has for ballet, and she shares it with anyone willing to absorb it, says Zalman Raphael, Carolina Ballet's artistic director and CEO, who's known about Austin for 20 years, since he was a child honing his craft at the New York City Ballet. Debbie is an icon, a legend, if there ever was one. Austin still spends her days in a ballet studio, now coaching, teaching the next generation her mastery of Giselle. Her daughters are grown, pursuing their own passions, but still inspired by where they came from. Balanchine saw something in my mom, which led her to pave the way for countless women and women of color, says daughter Olivia. Every day, I'm proud to be her daughter. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the Nature Department, an eye on eagles, checking out the antics of dozens of bald eagles at Jordan Lake, by Mike Dunn. I've been fascinated by our national symbol, the bald eagle, since my teenage years. Back then, my family had a cottage on a tidal tributary of the Potomac River near Stafford, Virginia. Bald eagles were quite rare in the East, but we were fortunate to have a nest across the water from our place. I was always thrilled to see them flying over or catching fish when I was out in my canoe. They're large raptors, but capable of some impressive aerial maneuvers. To be able to observe them was quite a privilege, especially back then. Then some 40 years ago, I was lucky enough to be present when a juvenile eagle was released at Lake Matamuskete on the North Carolina coast as part of a statewide reintroduction effort. Thanks to protection and conservation efforts, bald eagle populations have rebounded, and they're now commonly seen near large bodies of water throughout almost all of North America. Here in the Piedmont, falls and Jordan Lakes provide great eagle habitats since they're large, shallow lakes with good fish populations and an abundance of protected, forested shoreline. A few years ago, I started seeing great photos on social media of eagles and other fish-eating birds taken at the B. Everett Jordan Dam. On my first visit, I saw three or four eagles either perched or actively fishing in the tail race below the dam. So last February, with lake levels high and lots of water being discharged through the dam, I drove the 25 minutes from our house over to the dam again. My plan was to go over early in the morning, stay a couple hours, then head home before lunch. Steve McMurray, a ranger at Jordan Lake State Recreation Area, shared that the lake is now home to over 25 eagle nests, and he estimates the winter population at more than 60 eagles, with perhaps double or triple that number in the summer. I counted over 40 on this visit, many more than when I had visited the year before. The eagles I saw were a mix of juveniles and adults. It takes 4 to 5 years for a bald eagle to acquire the signature white head and tail feathers. Bald eagles are superbly adapted to finding prey and catching it. The eyes of an eagle are one of its most impressive features. They're almost the same weight as a human eye, even though an adult eagle might weigh only 10 to 14 pounds. No one knows exactly how much better an eagle can see than us, but estimates range anywhere from 4 to 8 times the visual acuity of a human. Given their large size, wingspans exceed 6 feet, and superb predator adaptations, bald eagles can easily dominate the scene at a carcass or feeding area. They're also happy to steal their prey from other predators, like cormorants and osprey. If a cormorant doesn't swallow a fish right away, the eagles perched nearby or soaring overhead take notice. An eagle may dive bomb a cormorant, causing it to hastily drop its meal. The eagle then swoops in, talons down, snags it off the surface, and flies off to a nearby tree to dine on its stolen prey. As for the osprey, bald eagles may also nab a fish in midair from their raptor cousins, which is always an aerial display worth seeing. What I'd planned as a 2-hour photo trip turned into an all-day event that had me twisting and turning at times to try to catch the action. It was a thrilling day of observing some of the large concentration of bald eagles that call Jordan Lake their winter home. This article was edited for Time. Next, Burning Bright. Bright Black uses its candles to honor African American history and culture, by Finn Cohen. June of 2020 was a seismic month for the United States. Pandemic, protests, economic recession, lockdown. And for Tiffany Griffin and Daryl Heron, the married founders of the Durham-based candle company, Bright Black, that tumult was translating into an overload of work, a nearly 1,200% jump in orders from 1 month to the next. That spike was the result of a Twitter, now X, thread of Black-owned candle companies. Bright Black's Ida candle, named for Ida B. Wells and representing the work of Black women advancing women's right to vote, was at the top of the thread. The deluge of orders was a shock to a small company that had only been operating for a year. Bright Black had to stop taking orders on full-sized candles because they couldn't fill them. Then, a couple weeks later, Beyoncé listed Bright Black on her website as part of a directory of Black-owned businesses. That set off another wave of demand, and by August, they had to stop taking orders for miniature candles. They resumed taking orders by November of that year, and since then, Bright Black has been busy. They've hired staff and found a storefront. They've been commissioned to make custom candles by the NBA and WNBA, the North Carolina Museum of Art, the filmmaker Jordan Peele, and the former First Lady Michelle Obama. They developed two different thematic collections. Diaspora features scents inspired by cities of black greatness, like Kingston, Jamaica, which has an aroma of rum, grapefruit, and sugarcane, Salvador, Brazil, with acai, palm, and sea salt, and Durham, North Carolina, with tobacco and whiskey aromas. While the genres set celebrates musical genres created by the black diaspora, like gospel, with aromas of chamomile, myrrh, and lilac, bacata with tropical essences, and hip-hop with shea butter and evergreen. Griffin entered Boston College in 1998, intending to make documentaries that could handle the nuances she wanted to highlight. Then she studied psychology and communications, receiving a PhD in psychology from the University of Michigan. After 2 years of postdoctoral work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, she entered a fellowship to Washington, D.C., and joined USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, at a time when the State Department was trying to coordinate development around the concept of resilience. I was basically brought in to define resilience, to figure out how to measure it, to help people design programs to incorporate it, and to take data and weave that into better programs, says Griffin. Over the course of 7 years, Griffin traveled back and forth to countries like Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Senegal, looking at ways to create policies to prepare communities for things like conflict, famine, flood, or inflation. But over time, she and Heron, whom she met on the first day of college but didn't start dating until later, wanted to get out of D.C., especially after having had a child. Durham, which she was familiar with from her time at UNC, hit all the right notes. Small, diverse, and growing. Candles may seem like a stark pivot, but the idea had been in the works for a while. Griffin and Heron made their own candles out of curiosity and frugality while still in D.C., gifting them to their families one Christmas to great acclaim. But it wasn't until they struck on the idea of making a scent based on the creativity of hip-hop that a larger vision emerged, and Griffin drew up a business plan. Bright Black's location in Durham's Lakewood Shopping Center serves as a retail outfit for the candles, as well as the development and production center. Large jars of oils sit on the shelves in the back, where their small team works on filling orders. The scents are incredibly distinctive, with tones that can fill a room. The Salvador candle in the Diaspora collection is elegant, almost like a cologne, while the flagship hip-hop candle is a deep, rich combination of shea butter and oud. All the candles come in black matte vessels with wooden wicks that can burn up to 80 hours. The candles provide the canvas for Griffin and Heron to express themselves, and those expressions aren't going unnoticed. In 2022, to celebrate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court, they developed a candle called Justice, with Desiree Davis, an artist, in Cary. The image on the vessel depicted Lady Justice as a black woman with dreadlocks. The candle is no longer available, but Bright Black keeps making them for one particular customer, Justice Jackson herself. She places orders all the time, says Griffin. This article was edited for Time. Next, Pressed with Care. Decree Company practices a vintage art to create custom stationery by Colony Little. The storefront window at Decree Company frames a Chandler and Price letterpress machine that's more than 100 years old. There, you can witness the oversized flywheel of the press whirl into action. It sets three rollers in motion that spread ink onto a large round plate, then deposit the ink onto a template. The operator then inserts a piece of paper in front of the template and pulls a crank arm. This presses the ink and image deep into the paper. We love people watching what we do. It's like a functional museum, says Tracy Taylor, a master engraver in the studio. The team at Decree Company is in the business of creating magical moments with paper. All of the store's stationery is designed and created in its Martin Street studio. Co-owners Ryan Dart and Robert Bueller founded the business in 2020, originally operating out of an old warehouse space. The two opened this flagship store in 2022. The studio boutique specializes in handcrafted, bespoke stationery, designed and created by a passionate team of illustrators and artisans. Their designs range from whimsical and graphic to gilded and classic. According to Bueller, personalized stationery is extremely popular right now. Once a design is created, the image is transferred to a template through a chemical process called etching, which burns images onto a copper plate. These plates are used with letterpress printing, which uses the machine to push the inked image into paper. A more specialized process called engraving is sort of the opposite of letterpress. Instead of pushing the design onto the paper, a machine creates a raised impression of the image in ink. The machinery, process, and materials in the engraving process are more involved and time-consuming than traditional letterpress. It requires two plates, a negative and a positive, to push the image forward from the back and deposit the ink onto the page from the front. But engraving supports the use of fine typefaces and intricately drawn templates that result in a refined, luxurious feel. Decree frequently uses inks infused with gold and silver, which add a light and a sculptural quality to the designs. While traditional printing and letterpress techniques each offer advantages in time and cost, the beauty of engraving lies in craftsmanship and passion that goes into it. It's a very difficult process, but the final product is absolutely stunning, says Bueller. For visitors to the store who are interested in experiencing the craft of letterpress, Decree also offers group classes in the shop. Visitors can take a class and create something unique for a loved one. For the team at Decree, the rewards of their distinct line of work vary. Taylor noted a surprising outcome that comes from facing the challenges he encounters mastering this craft form. Even when I'm working through problems like having to fix a machine or something, it's fun, he says. We are merely stewards of these machines, and that's one of the things that I really love about our ethos. We're trying to help keep a craft alive. This article was edited for Time. And from the end note, a grand vision. The new downtown Cary Park was decades in the making, and it's perfect for today, by Anne-Marie Klar. The downtown Cary Park opened to much excitement in mid-November. A 7-acre plot packed with all the amenities you could want: walking paths, play spaces, an amphitheater, dog park, concessions, and more. Just 20 minutes from downtown Raleigh, it's nestled between Academy and Walker Streets, close to popular restaurants and the Performing Arts Center, and will be a new anchor for Cary. Over the decades, the property had been developed around the edges, but not in the interior. But in 2001, the Cary Town Council approved a plan to create a park as a focal point for downtown. For a town of our size, especially back then, it was impressive for the leadership to have that kind of foresight, says Joy Ennis, the park's general manager. 5 years ago, the town selected OJB, a national landscape and urban planning firm, to design the park with input from the community. Today, the park offers several unique amenities. There's an inventive play area featuring a pair of play structures that look like cardinals. A large stormwater pond acts as an attractive water feature with stones at the perimeter that entice kids to play. A skywalk rises into the tree canopy to offer a different perspective. And dog owners love the Bark Bar, where they can enjoy a beverage as the pups cavort, divided into areas for the biggies and the smalls. Ennis says she might be most excited about the botanic gardens, though. We planted 66,000 plants, and once they're established, they'll create these amazing quiet spaces for people to enjoy. Though the park is just a couple months old, it's been completely adopted by everybody, says Ennis. People are using it just how we hoped they would. From an economic standpoint, Cary's already seeing the benefits of the park as it draws residents and visitors to the area. Ennis believes it will serve as a destination in Cary in the decades to come. The design and bones of it are so strong. It has real staying power, she says. And it'll evolve as we create more programming and events. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.